Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. We are well into the 50s now, and it's now May 2023. I think we've been a bit quiet recently, but we are up and underway trying to get as many of these episodes recorded. You see, I'm here, just two of us today. Me and Christy are here. It's quite late here, 10:30, so Sophie is in bed, and Andrew today is not feeling very well. We cancelled another one earlier today, so here we are. Christy, nice to have you on the podcast.
Oh, it's nice to be here, and I'm sorry to hear that Andrew is feeling under the weather and that I didn't have an opportunity to talk with Sophie on this recording as well, but it's all good.
Sophie goes to bed about 9 o'clock.
Okay.
She's an early go to sleep person. So us two are rather go to sleep a little bit later. So it's not too bad these late episodes, but we're good. So what I normally do to kind of introduce the podcast, just ask the guests just to kind of introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about them, tell us what they're doing at the moment in terms of job, and then we'll go straight into it.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, I am so glad to be here and have this time with you, John. My name is Christy Robison. I am an IT consultant and have been for a little over 10 years doing mostly compliance and governance on the Microsoft 365 stack, but have been expanding into a bit of Viva and a little bit of Syntex as well. Before that, I worked in the oil and gas industry in the business analyst and IT and project management roles. And I've seen a lot of interesting things happen along the way.
So what's the company you work for at the moment?
My current company is Paint Rock Consulting. It is my own company with a couple of contractors here and there. And, you know, I imagine that there probably we're going to see a lot more companies like this spring up in the near term. We've heard in the news all of the layoffs from different large tech service companies. And it's interesting to see where some of the people who have been impacted by that are spinning up new consultancies or new niches or, you know, bringing online their side hustles. So it's very interesting to be in the consulting space right now with all of that expertise flying around.
Yeah, I've seen quite a few people here and there just spinning up their own thing, because I think it's probably a good time now more than ever to kind of do that, especially if you've unfortunately been made redundant, laid off, or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah.
So let's go back. Let's talk about young Christy. What was you doing at school? Kind of, what did you aspire to be?
You know, that's interesting in the context of this podcast too. I was thinking about that recently. Originally, I wanted to be a chemist, except I didn't really know what I wanted to do. That was like an elementary school. I wanted the white lab coat, basically, and not have to deal with sick people. So in my mind, that was chemistry. But, you know, in high school, it kind of morphed a little bit more into science, computer science. I ended up getting a scholarship for the School of Business. So I went into finance for my undergraduate studies, and I really just hated it. I talked to an advisor, how difficult would it be perhaps to change my major to computer science and still keep my scholarship? And that was not going to fly. I had to stay in the College of Business to keep that scholarship. So I did for a bit longer. But, you know, one of the things I think kids have better grasp of today than I had when I was leaving high school and entering college is a little bit more of an awareness or access to information about what all these potential jobs might be. I remember looking through the course catalog and seeing things that I didn't even know exactly what they were. So I felt like, how can you ask a child to choose a major when they're still in high school before they've, you know, even had exposure to some of the things that might be possible to them?
Yeah, sometimes you feel like you need a year of experience of what's out there before you can make a decision of what your future is. Because I'm pretty sure that when we were both at school, we wouldn't know what a consult an IT consultant did or anything like that. Even though probably day to day you worked with Microsoft in IT classes and stuff like that, you don't quite grasp what the real world is when you're doing some of these things. I never had the chance at school to do kind of like coding or anything like that. My school just didn't really do that. So like being a data scientist and all that type of stuff is kind of alien. You wouldn't really know what that was when I went to school, in honesty. So yeah,
I
strange,
think,
but I went to a small school.
well, and that's great too. You know, if you're in a, if you're lost in a classroom with 500 people learning technical information or skills, that's really hard to absorb in an environment like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had a couple of like we had schools like classes of like 20, 25, but
Oh,
it was
lovely.
still a yeah, still was it's a small, still quite a small. But yeah, so I completely agree with that. And how did you find kind of like the mix of when did you kind of go get into that IT section? So you followed like you went into the business, you got a scholarship there, you decided you kind of peered over the fence at the IT section. When did you kind of like actually make that move and start to get into that field?
Well, not until I was well into my working years. It didn't happen for quite a while. I had, you know, I continued and eventually finished the business degree, and that was going to allow me kind of this broad landscape, I guess, of opportunities, right? Everything is business, essentially. So, I just couldn't really pinpoint exactly what I wanted to do, and I liked trying a lot of new things. So I went a lot of different directions early on. Actually, I started doing some sculptural work and backpacking overseas, and you know, I had a lot of little gaps and tangents. But ultimately, I thought, okay, I need to settle down a little bit and get more into the swing of the day job and, you know, the reliable job, and started with an oil and gas company in a little bit more of a kind of a safety advisor role. And the I had some computer experience. I've always had computers since a TRS-80 way back when, and would take them apart and put them together and would do basic little, you know, my basic coding. But when I joined this oil and gas company, they had a 3-year rolling average for safety statistics that had to be reported on to federal agencies, state agencies. And, you know, so that was also my introduction to compliance, regulatory compliance. But this very, very complex spreadsheet that had these 3-year rolling averages was, I don't know if you've run across this term in the UK, but we hear it here a lot in the US about cowboy programming or secret programming. It's basically where you have crafted an Excel that is so heavily detailed with lots of interconnected macros and interconnected calculations that aren't necessarily logged anywhere in like a notes page. So it took a while to kind of figure that out when somebody else had left the company. But once I did, that was my love affair with Excel started. And then I just continued to keep going deeper into tech from the business side. Eventually, I joined
In
it.
the interestingly enough, sorry, in the UK, a cowboy is normally associated with someone who doesn't do things that well, if you go on. So you have like cowboy plumbers, cowboy electricians, and cowboy IT companies, and all that type of stuff. So that's quite a an normal term. I don't know if Andrew wants to keep this in the podcast, but I used to work for a company. it was run by Indians. So whole family of people from guys from India, and one of the guys' catchphrase was, "Well, you've had the cowboys, now you've got the Indians."
Oh,
and he used to say that quite regularly. So,
oh wow!
There you go. Well, but if Andrew wants to keep that in or not, like that's not coming from my mouth. I'm just quoting.
Okay. Well, I think it adds historical context, right? You wouldn't necessarily say that today, or hear people saying that today.
I mean, right? I would never say that. Yeah. I'm just an interesting story that comes from there, right? Yeah.
I think it's good. It shows a progression of how far we've come, I think, in the working environment, in the working space.
Sorry.
That's what the spreadsheet was. It was kind of being a cowboy spreadsheet isn't the best term. Perhaps a better analogy would be a Frankensheet, a Franken workbook, Frankenstein workbook, right? Yeah, yeah. It had lots of different bits and pieces, and they didn't necessarily work well with each other. Sometimes they calculated things differently. So, my deep dive into Excel was figuring out what all the macros were, what the equations were, what the regulatory requirements for those equations and calculations were, and doing a bit of, cleanup and organization and some streamlining, a little bit of automation in there where I could. I had computers as a kid that I would play with, but I couldn't quite put together how to make use of this utility in the working world until that particular position. And gosh, then I was in oil and gas for quite a while, almost 15 years. So I was able to do a lot of projects, some that are, there are different aspects to an oil and gas industry. There's upstream, which is where people like geologists and biologists are employed to help understand where within the earth there might be fossil fuels. And there's that's the exploration or the upstream side of an oil and gas operation, is finding the product or finding the source. And then the downstream portion of the organization is, once that source is found, extracting it, refining it, transporting it, delivering it. So I was able to work in both the upstream and the downstream of the industry, in small and large projects, and some domestic and international. And each one of them seemed to have gaps or issues that could be solved by technology. And I became kind of known as the person who could find the technology to close some of the gaps. Mm-hmm. But I think where the real light bulb moment was for me that I could probably do this full time and really enjoy it was during a project that spanned 8 states. So this was in the early 2000s. At that time, SharePoint was WSS or Windows SharePoint Server 3.0 and server-based. But what we needed was something for this project that would allow people across 8 different states in the U.S. and 2 time zones to be able to communicate and share information more real-time, or at least real-time close. This was in the days when internet was still dial-up and it was maybe 128, K-bound. So having something web-based that was fairly static, that could be maintained by just a handful of people to reduce bandwidth on, changing and updating things. That was a really great introduction, not just for this particular project team and the people that were involved in it, but for me, from the technical side. I was able to pilot that, and then in conjunction with that company's Microsoft partner at the time, we were able to make a business case for bringing SharePoint Server into the company. At that time, it was still 3.0, and then eventually, 2003 and 2007 and on. And then I finally left the oil and gas industry to to branch out on my own for IT consulting in 2012. I loved being able to do more IT heavy work within the oil and gas industry. And that's a very varied industry for the technical depth of expertise just throughout the whole business, right? From beginning to end, and even more so in the technology arena. But I felt like it was kind of a silo. I wanted to gain exposure as an employee to different industry verticals and applications for technology that I wouldn't necessarily have strictly within the oil and gas organization. So I finally found my calling at a later age, because I did break out into consulting, IT consulting, specifically on SharePoint at that time, then SharePoint Online, and then Microsoft 365. Which I just absolutely love. So there are some areas that I don't have deep expertise in 365 that I would like to build some additional expertise, like around Power Platform. But a lot of the things that are available now are things that I think, you know, with different project teams over the past, I've had conversations with people, gosh, you know what, it would be really great if you could broadcast communications just to the people who need it, just when they need it, in the flow of work. And, you know, so some of those things that had been pipe dreams years before are things that the 365 platform can make a reality today, or that are just native to 365, you know, and don't necessarily, you know.
What's quite amazing, and what I was thinking about earlier, is just like how far the IT industry has just come in 20 years. The fact that back then it was such a big project. I imagine it's such a massive project, over 8 states to have SharePoint for file sharing, which was, as you said, not really real time, probably a little bit out. But now it's that could be done worldwide in 15 minutes. Like,
yes. Well, in fact, what we ended up using for that particular project across multiple states was a product that was available at the time called eRooms. I think they have since been bought by Documentum and then by OpenText, but it was wholly browser-based, web browser-based. So, you know, I knew that a solution that was going to work for this project team, who was going to be spending a lot of time on the road, a lot of drive time, a lot of time hands-on with, you know, the equipment related to the project. These were not going to be people who were in an office all day. They might be at a work site or field locations. So just being able to maybe phone in information to kind of our operations center, and one or two core people could update the e-rooms content or the different libraries. It was very much kind of a precursor to what SharePoint Online is today. Extremely simplified, yeah. You know.
The space from there to now in 20 years is just incredible, really.
Really is.
So yes. You've been 10 years of Paint Rock Consulting. I picked up 10 years, and I'm guessing that business major kind of helped out with scoping what it was like, I guess.
You know, it has. There are some things that I think that was really useful for. Let's say if I had a magic wand and could go back in time and flip things and study computer science and not have the business experience, I'm not sure that I would have eventually gone opened my own consultancy. You know, I wouldn't have necessarily had the experience in the business arena to have the confidence to step out on my own, perhaps. Mm. We can always, you know, 2020 is hindsight's 2020, is that the saying? But I think it worked out well for me to have that as my foundation and then be continuously drawn deeper into the technology stack over my time in the oil and gas industry.
So when you opened Paint Rock, was it Microsoft's consultant? Is it Microsoft Technologies you was primarily focusing on? And kind of why was it just Microsoft? Is it because you picked up the SharePoint skills and stuff, and that's kind of what your expertise was, and or did you kind of said you wanted to branch out into some other areas? Is it just Microsoft basically?
Yeah, well, primarily it is. I will do other things. So for let me add a little bit of context.
It's fine being just Microsoft because I am completely Microsoft. I don't do anything else. So.
Yeah. Well, I would say I'm pretty much within the almost wholly in the Microsoft stack. But when I started PaintRock Consulting Services, I also wanted to. I had been relocating a lot for business and traveling a lot for work, and I didn't want to do that so much anymore. I wanted to live in the place that I didn't feel I had to escape from to go on vacation. So I moved from a very big city, Houston, Texas. I think at the time it was about 6 million people. I moved from there to my very favorite place, which is a small rural town in Wyoming. So for those of you who might not know where Wyoming is in the States, people probably have heard of Colorado and the Rocky Mountain Range. Just north of Colorado is Wyoming, and we have Grand Teton National Park and Yellowstone National Park on the west side of the state.
What TV shows are famous for that area?
Yellowstone is a TV series. I think it's Kevin Costner TV series that's active now. It's filmed up in Montana, but it's based kind of on the Wyoming cowboy story. And virtually any nature show like PBS Nature or Nova or some of the David Attenborough specials about the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There's a lot of documentary information about this area, but it's so rich in outdoor recreation, which, you know, was my bailiwick for quite a long time. So I thought, okay, I'm going to open up this company, but I also want to live in a place where I don't have to travel 2 days to, to embark on a hiking trip or a camping trip.
There's some big films based in, whilst we're on it, why not? Based in it, Bridesmaids, the 2011 chick flick is based there.
Oh, gosh, I didn't know that. And I thought I saw that. I'm going to have to revisit that.
And so was Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Really? Oh, my gosh. Well, there's another TV series on Netflix called Longmire. It's kind of Western themed. It's about a sheriff named Longmire, who's played by an Australian, Robert Taylor. The story series takes place in Wyoming, and a lot of the fictional places are near here or within about 60 miles of where I live. But that's actually filmed in New Mexico. So visually, you can't make a one-to-one comparison. But apparently, let's just say
So was Rampage, the Dwayne the Rock Johnson movie. It was based in Wyoming Forest. There you go. Nice. Listen, trivia for anyone that's listening. Yeah. Basically, if there's a place I don't know, I kind of look up to see kind of what TV and films were based in that area. And then Brokeback Mountain was as well, actually.
Oh, yes. Yep. It covered some of Montana and Wyoming. I think people in the States most often associate Wyoming with Old Faithful, the geothermic geyser. At Yellowstone National Park, it goes off every, it's becoming, I think it's a little bit more spaced out now. Maybe it's like every 94 minutes or something like that. But I'm about 150 miles due east of Yellowstone National Park. So some of those nature shows and science shows talk about how the Yellowstone caldera is due for a major, explosion or major volcano because it's been 600,000 years since the last one. So if you see my background start to really vibrate and a lot of rumbling,
that volcano going?
That's probably going to be my last breath.
Let's talk about some of the work in tech that you currently do. You currently do.
Sure. So what I really love is helping companies make the most of their 365 licensing. Oftentimes, I'll work with an organization who might have E5 or E3 licensing, and they have a business need, but they've really only been utilizing the licensing for just to get their day-to-day business done. So email, documents, mm-hmm. spreadsheets. They may or may not be heavily utilizing Teams very much. They may be concerned about firewall protection or email encryption or some of the other things, or compliance posture or security posture. So those are always great opportunities to help a company understand what their licensing model is that they're paying for and what benefits that are out of the box, figuratively speaking, in relation to those licenses that they're not utilizing that could answer some of those problems or could solve some of those issues for them. And then I also love the flip side of that. So that's maybe a little bit more gain in operational benefit. The flip side of that, I consider a little bit more, maybe a little bit more creatively challenging for me, and maybe a little bit more dynamic, is smaller businesses or startups where there's a lot more freeform thinking. You know, a business that's been around 20 years or 100 years, they have very different ways of thinking about how to do their business. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those types of organizations require or could benefit from something like an art of the possible discussion. Well, your licensing has these features. What would you say if I told you that you could, you know, automate your regulatory compliance evaluation in the stack that you're already mm-hmm. utilizing, or that you already have a bit of, you know, your e-discovery or your retention management, or depending on how you're configured, perhaps on an E5, maybe you are ripe for, maybe you have a number of the components already in place for your zero trust security perimeter.
That's what I love talking about the most, to be fair. It's,
the security.
Talking to customers at the moment about an E3 to E5 uplift, or currently just what are you using and what can you do better within security? I just talk about security all day when it comes to that side of things.
Yes. Well, it's fascinating, you know, I think it also depends on the company and what industry that they're in. So some companies that I work with don't have an IT department, and I'll fill a fractional or partial role of maybe CIO or COO, helping ramp up some operationalization of their technology stack, or driving some metrics, or just even helping an organization define what their governance policy is going to be. Maybe they don't have one yet. There are some regulations that are coming online in the US right now, well, in a few weeks, that require more businesses than just banks, for example, to employ greater data privacy protections. And so that's catching a couple of companies by surprise because they haven't needed to do this in the past. And now they're going to be required to have, you know, some sort of a documentation on how they protect data and customer privacy. So there are always some external changes that businesses have to deal with. And I think I can bring a little bit of insight into that from, you know, from the business experience side of things, as well as the consulting side of things on one fence, you know, on one or the other side of the fence. So, you know, it all depends on the company and what their need is and what their outreach might be. One of the things that I'm not comfortable with as a business owner, and this is something that I think all business owners find, is it helps to learn quickly where your weaknesses are and fill those weaknesses. So it's unrealistic to expect one person to be an expert in everything. I've learned I'm not an expert in like the sales and marketing channel thing. I love talking about tech. I love solving problems. I love people, helping people kind of connect the dots and, oh yeah, this is great. And then when they start seeing like one or two of those dominoes fall, having that momentum build and, you know, just being a champion or a partner to a company to help them see what they can achieve more of with what they have, or if they are already fully utilizing, you know, their licensing, what might they think of next as their next product evolution or their next service evolution, and where the 365 stack might help them be able to facilitate those things.
Do you do much talking or anything like that at conferences and in user groups and stuff like that?
I was a late bloomer into that role too. I did my first SharePoint Saturday in 2018, and then COVID hit. two years later it impacted. But I have really made an effort to join a little bit more of the speaking opportunity. So I've presented with a client previously at Microsoft 365 in Las Vegas last year on building an information governance program.
I was there this year.
Yeah. Oh,
I was there at the beginning of the month.
You know, I had major FOMO this time around for missing it. I had a few other conflicts lined up, so I think I'm definitely going to have to go back next year. But you know, I've done a few conference sessions here and there. I have a few coming up. One of them is Viva Around the World with Zoe and Kevin McDonald and a few others. And another one is, so I've done some Microsoft speaking, but one of my goals this year was to branch out beyond Microsoft specific and speak more at conferences for information governance, information awareness, communications, communications and governance intersections. So I've been able to do a little bit of that, and I have a bit more of it on the horizon for the year. And I really enjoy that. I was so nervous.
The reason
first
I asked,
time.
To be fair, was because I was thinking to myself, I think you'd be an awesome speaker. So I thought I'd ask.
Oh, great.
That was why. Well, it's good to see you doing stuff with the Beaver Explorers, as they call themselves. Zoe's a really good friend of mine. So I talk daily in group chats with Zoe. So, yeah.
Well, I met her through Women in Teams. She's been very active in the Women in Teams group. So for those who might not know, that's a community group. I think it's been around about 4 years now. And it went quiet for a little bit, but I think it's having a bit of new life breathed into it. And Zoe is one of the main, you know, proponents of helping driving that forward. But it's basically a Microsoft Teams community that's open to women in tech and men in tech who support women in tech.
I'm actually in it. Andrew's in it, and people like Pete Rising and a few others are in there as well. So I think we've had like literally most people within that Women in Tech to be in the teams.
Oh, on your podcast?
I think we've had Laurie in there. We've had obviously Zoe. We've had lots of people over the years on the podcast from the community. So yeah, it's an awesome one for us to tap into for guests.
It's a great resource too. And they have, I think Zoe and Kevin have, and Sarah have also been instrumental in, I think it maybe just happened recently, like a speakers bureau.
Yeah, new speakers,
right?
Yes. That was just last Saturday. So, Sarah, Zoe, and Luke Evans, again, like close friends of mine. Like I went to Vegas with Luke. And Jose, our friendship group. I got major FOMO. Like those three don't normally do much without me, so I was like really getting FOMO. They were out and I were there. So I done a video for it anyway. So I was there in a video capacity.
Oh,
so
great!
It's nice to be in there some way, I guess. But I was getting Jose messaging me going, "Oh, we miss you." But hopefully we'll be back together at the next the Scottish Summit anyway. Scottish Summit's in August, and South Coast Summit. And hopefully we get accepted again for the Microsoft 365 conference in Vegas.
Yeah, in December.
No, I think Vegas two times in a year is going to be too much. So hopefully we can go again next May.
I think so too. So last year I went in May and I was really on the fence about going in December also. And I thought, no, I don't want to do it twice in 1 year. I'll just go back in May. I was thinking it would be later in May this year. It was a little bit earlier. Was it this year, like May 3rd? Or?
Yeah, it was like our talk was on the 30th of April. We'd done a workshop. A full-day workshop. Yeah, it was pretty good. Like we had a decent enough number. I think we had about 80 on it was a Sunday. So we had 80 there on 75 there on Sunday.
That's excellent.
And then the conference started on a Tuesday. So considering it was 2 days before, like I think we had the best attended on the Sunday. And then a Monday when there's a few more people there, I think they were getting into near enough the hundreds. And then I think if we'd done the Monday, we would have had more. But hopefully next year, they see how good we've done this year. And next year, we'll get to go again.
So what sessions did you do?
Security Masterclass in Microsoft 365.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So we've done the full front to back best practices on Microsoft 365 security. Went through the whole reference architecture for Microsoft 365, and then Jose and Daly, another friend of ours, done a Sentinel out of the box experience, how to go through, set it up, and all that type of stuff.
It was
a full day, and then Monday we relaxed. We spent the day in a pool having a couple of drinks and stuff like that, and then went out, and it was a good day. And then Tuesday, first day of the conference, then I headed home. Unfortunately, I didn't spend. I felt like I needed longer.
Well, now you know for next time.
Now right? I know. I said to my wife, I needed longer out there. Like she's like, oh, you seem like you was there forever. I was like, nah, I need another day at least.
If that's going to ultimately become a one-time-a-year conference. You know, it seemed like it used to be SharePoint conference. And when it was SharePoint conference, it was really, really, I don't mean this negatively, but it was kind of insular. Like, it was often a lot of the same speakers, but it was all SharePoint all the time with maybe a hint of Power Apps or a hint of Teams. And I want to say maybe in 2018, they really started opening it up to a bit more. That year in 2018, I also went to Inspire Ignite, yes, yeah. In Orlando. And yes, that Inspire. Just was way too big, I thought.
Was that 2019 one?
2018.
I went to Ignite in 2019. That was just huge, wasn't it?
Oh my gosh. So it sounds like now that there's the Power Platform Conference, and I think there's a Teams conference and a Teams Around the World and a Teams 10X, and maybe I really like the M365 avenue or turn that the Vegas conference has taken. And now that it seems a little bit more solidified, that, you know, there was the interruption with COVID. It was virtual for a bit. Because it was virtual, I think they broke it up into two times per year to be able to get, well, to be able to be flexible. And
well, to be fair, like, I think it's really well attended. There was like the keynote, it was full, like lots and lots of people there. I think they've done a really good job. It seemed to be really well organized and stuff like that. So the audio equipment, all of that type of stuff was all on point. So then the app, they use Hoover as an app, and that was amazing. Like, to build a community and stuff, it was really, really cool. It's top marks in my opinion. So yeah, we've all got our fingers crossed we can do it again next year. As I said, like, hopefully it's all the good numbers and good feedback, and we can do it again next year.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things that was one of the organizer takeaways from this year. They had a call for speakers, and they received, I think when they sent out a summary, they received something like 300 more submittals per session than they could possibly do. So it became a real challenge for them to kind of have carve it down to choose who would be presenting on the sessions. So maybe that's why they do keep it twice a year. I don't know. I'm just second guessing Microsoft here. Sure. But I think it's such a valuable conference because if you're not sure you're in Power Platform guru land or not sure you want to be a team guru land, that's the best place to kind of get the best mix of everything. If you're more developer oriented, the Build conference is happening
this week.
And they're doing it virtual, hybrid, and in person. So that helps, you know, that makes it much more accessible and available to a lot of people who can't be, you know, in Seattle
just think
this week.
A conference, for me, like a conference just has to be in person. Like I've tried the virtual ones and you don't get it. You don't, like, a conference isn't just, it's not just the sessions, it's everything else. It's the meeting the different people, it's the socializing, it's the networking, it is the sessions as well. That's the main attraction, obviously. And I think stuff like Build and Microsoft Build and Ignite and stuff, you do kind of get to, and even MVP Summit as well, like you get to know stuff a little bit earlier. Like it's done by Microsoft and stuff. But I think like these community ones, like their M365 conference and stuff, like that's where you start to, you know, you build your networks and stuff and stuff like that. So I met a lot of people that I'd only met virtually and stuff, and even new people that hopefully become good friends in the future. So that's what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have the people that I've met at conferences, I count as really true friends. You know, we go on vacation and meet up and, you know, we make an effort to see each other outside of just a conference here and there, which is important for me because I'm way up here in this tiny little remote corner of Wyoming by choice, admittedly. But I do love, you know, getting into being able to do an in-person session, because you're right, there's nothing that can quite match that camaraderie. I think people do a really good job of trying to match that in Teams and, you know, with all of the additional accessibility features that are standard in Teams now, it makes that a much more robust platform to facilitate greater engagement. But I think there's still such a benefit to those face-to-face conferences that you just can't fully replicate.
I don't mean to sound bad, but the virtual ones I use as like a warm-up, like to it's like training, it's like a training session, if you get what I mean. Like we test different sessions, we test, like, you know, all that type of stuff, and then when you get to the conference, that's like the main event, the one that you really want to like kind of perform for.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, I think I've done that with one session that I'm going to be presenting in person in July. I have been able to do it virtually earlier this year. And the thing that's great about that is, well, there are pros and cons. It's great because you can kind of get that gauge. But in some conferences, the way that they're set up, you might not be able to see the people that you're speaking to. I was on one recently that was through like an event management app, and there was a producer assigned. So the producer could say, you know, and I could see chat messages that came up, but I couldn't see faces. And I've been camera on since pre-COVID.
Yeah, that's that's what I mean. Yeah. Like you can't get, like, especially those virtual ones where, you know, everyone's got their camera off. You can see there's like 20, 30 people in the room, but you can't gauge reaction. And that's what everything's about. So I say I revise my content, like I revise the content, the timings, that type of thing. And, you know, if you need to put a demo in, if you need to take a demo out, if you need to add slides and stuff, but then all of that kind of a little bit goes out the window when you've got human interaction.
Yes. And it is. It ends up being a different bundle that you deliver in person versus what you can do virtually. I did one recently for, there was Comms V Next conference in Denver, Colorado in April. And that originally was a unified communications conference. So think things like PBX and audio visual.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing it actually, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was talking about kind of the intersection of teams and governance as a for the communication platform. But because that group included people who had expertise around unified communications, I wanted it to be really interactive. You know, I could talk governance all day, I can talk teams all day, but what I can't do is add their perspective. So I tried to make it very interactive with just basics on the slides and then trying to pull or have questions that the audience could participate in to provide their experience and their insights. And I wasn't sure how that was going to go because I hadn't met a lot of the attendees before, but it went really well. I think it was very audience engaging. We had people who had, you know, one person would share their experience and then another person would echo off of that and mention how they solved that problem. And that's thing, you know, you can't really plan for that. You hope that it happens. But if you can't see a virtual audience, then, you know, you can't see the raised eyebrow that looks like somebody's just about to say something or the furrowed, you know, the furrowed brow that indicates maybe that didn't quite land. Maybe I need to make that point, you know, a different way.
If I mean, I usually co-present with Jose and Luke and it normally turns to chaos because we are normally, we're normally kind of like trying to one up each other. There's a lot of banter all the way through. And sometimes if the audience don't enjoy it and I'm not laughing or anything like it becomes sometimes you've got to wind it back. But it normally turns into chaos. Normally. anyway. Well,
That's what you learned, right?
Before, like when it's me just me talking, we go completely off subject, and I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I've got 10 minutes. It's 11:20 at night here. I need to go back because I'm going to Florida tomorrow, so I'm flying.
My goodness, have a good flight.
So I do need to get wrapped up. Two questions to kind of end up. I would like for you to give me a moment in your career where you would say kind of like there's been a real kind of hard part of your career, and how did you kind of get through it?
Oh, that's a good question. So there are a lot of intersections that kind of play into this. I'll defer back to when I was working in oil and gas, which is a largely male-dominated industry. And then the technical piece or the IT piece in that industry is also fairly male-dominated. There weren't very many women in the areas where I was working. So oftentimes I would feel like I needed to have my suggestion fully baked, fully vetted, tested, and easy to demo to whoever my stakeholders were before I would even broach the subject with them. It turned out that wasn't the case, but I was holding myself to an unrealistically high standard because I didn't see other people like me doing what I was doing, and I couldn't really model what I was doing off of somebody else. But what I see today is really great. I love millennials and Gen Z. They understand community. You know, all the things that we've been talking about, the Microsoft community, the Teams community, the SharePoint community, that's all like baked into their DNA, and they're all digital natives. So they don't hesitate to reach out to somebody who might have the expertise about something, even if they're not necessarily in a department. They see things, I think, a lot more flatly in terms of, well, here's a person with this expertise. It doesn't matter if they're in the engineering organization. Mm. I'm just going to ask them. And I think that's fantastic because it's also barrier breaking and silo breaking, you know, in a manner of sharing information. I like that that's become much more natural to people in the workforce. And I also like that, you know, for technical things that somebody might want to demo, it's a lot easier to build something now. Let's say you are in a position where you actually do need to have something wireframed or mocked up or slightly demoable to people who might be making a go or no-go decision about your product. That's a lot easier to do now today, too, with you know, a demo tenant or a developer tenant or, you know, privileged information, you know, privileged access management, you know, maybe
I'm sitting here smiling because I'm just thinking to myself, DevOps. I mean, I've asked you to give me kind of like a really bad experience. You turned it on its head to like something really positive, which kind of shows how much of a positive person you are.
You know, that's really fascinating to hear. I tried to do that. I try to always find a silver lining, but I will say this.
But the second part to that question, that tell me, like, you know, the highlight of your career, like the creme de la creme so far.
Oh gosh.
So I'll go with a hard one, with a not so nice one into a nice one. So that I,
okay. gosh, I would say starting my own business and doing the consulting. You know, trust in yourself. Take chances, because the worst that can happen, now I realize this is maybe from a point of privilege. I'm not wealthy by any means, but you know, if as a business owner, I try something and it doesn't work, I'll just go in a different direction. But I love trying new things and taking chances and being a little bit less risk averse, because that has enabled me to grow tenfold. You know, I've been able to expand 10x based on what I was away from what I was just doing in an oil and gas industry, because I've had the opportunity to work with lots of different industries and, you know, enterprise, small and medium business, startup, a startup on Web3, you know, Web 3.0 and NFTs. And I just find that all fascinating. And my regret, I guess, is that I didn't have the confidence to take that step 10 years earlier. You know, I'm in an age that starts with a number 5. And in a lot of technical realms, that would be considered kind of dinosaurish. But it's not, because a lot of people my age and older are being great examples, because they're always learning. They're always sharing what they've learned with the rest of the community, helping other people learn what they've learned. And I think that's all been such a rewarding part of having launched my own business and continuing to help mentor young people who are interested in tech from all walks of life.
I think that's a great note to kind of end the podcast on. As I said to you before we started, I think we're gonna go down different tangents, and we are well over our normal time on the podcast. I'm just gonna go mad. You have to listen to this all back, but it's been a pleasure to have you. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Oh, likewise.
So thanks for joining us for another episode of the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. As I said before, been a fantastic guest. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, especially for, you know, in appreciation of how late it is and how far you're going to be traveling tomorrow.
No worries. Take care.
Happy travels. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. Please make sure you hit that like, share, and subscribe button to help us promote our message. You can also follow us on Twitter at MSFTSpotlight. And we're also on LinkedIn, the Microsoft Spotlight podcast. And finally, we'd like to tell you a little bit about BitTitan and thank them for sponsoring this podcast.
Remote migrations start here. Let MigrationWiz do the work for you. It's fast, secure, and 100% SaaS, which means you can migrate at any time and from anywhere. Migrate mailboxes, documents, public folders, personal archives, or even Microsoft Teams with just a few clicks. No special training needed, and no customer downtime. When the work matters, choose MigrationWiz.